thing they said to me, and the result was frustrating and humiliating. How was I supposed to function in this society when I lacked even the basic means of communication? I was still housed on the destroyer for now, illegally, I suspected, and solely at the discretion of the captain. Since he had taken me under his wing, I threw myself on his mercy, requesting that he come with me to my next interview. To my immense relief, he did not hesitate. He accompanied me through the form-filling and interviewing. The immigration official did not seem cowed by him exactly, but he tended to loom over the proceedings, and I never seriously doubted that they would let me into the country. The surprise came after, telling me he had something to discuss with me. The captain took me to a bar where the sailors gathered and ordered me a beer. "You being a grown-up and all," he said. I said nothing, sipping at the yellow liquid and trying to hide my wince of distaste. "Tell me about the mine," he said at last. I shrugged, not wanting to go over it all again. America was to be my new beginning. I didn't want to rehash my past any more. "I already told you," I said. "Tell me about the henge and what you saw under it," he said. He'd always been friendly in his dealings with me, and he still was. But for all his feigned casualness, his eyes now held an intensity I had never seen before. There was something specific he wanted to know. I didn't care, and thinking that the sooner I got past it, the faster I could leave it behind, I told him everything in detail. The concrete flytrap henge, the power system, the bell below it, and the strange material it was made of. I told him the odd behavior of the guards, the heightened layers of secrecy, and the ruthless way in which Ungerleiter had attempted to eradicate the work detail as soon as our task was complete. He frowned thoughtfully, staring at his beer glass, and said nothing for a long moment before nodding. "There's someone I want you to meet," he said. I immediately began to shake my head, but he raised a hand. "There might be work in it," he said. "Pay." "I don't need it," I said. It was a lie, and he knew it, but he let that slide. "It's not about what you need, Jersey," he said, and his manner was different now, as if he had decided to say something he had hoped he wouldn't have to. "A few weeks ago, everyone in this city was celebrating the end of the war." "Yes," I said. "So?" "So what if it isn't over?" I stared at him. "What do you mean?" I asked. "The Japanese?" "I'm not talking about the Japanese," he interrupted, "or the Italians, or even the Germans. I'm talking about the Nazis." I made a face. "What's the difference?" I said. "The Germans are a people. They are bound by blood, and geography, and history. The Nazis are something quite different. What binds them is an ideology, a world view, and a purpose. The Germans were defeated. In time, they will rebuild as a functioning nation, and their sense of who they are will change. But the Nazis, we killed a lot of them, and some of the survivors will turn back into Germans, like people waking from a nightmare. But we did not cut the head off the snake. Some of them live on, in Germany, and—" he shifted in his seat, and I sensed his nervousness. "Elsewhere." "Where?" I asked. "You said there were three planes," he said. Reading my confusion, he pressed on, his voice low and urgent. "At the Wenceslas mine, three big cargo planes, loaded with whatever came out of the underground factory." "Yes," I said, wary of his sudden intensity, unnerved by it. "You shot one down," he said. "One was captured by the Russians. What happened to the other?" "I told you, it got away," I said. "I don't want to talk about this." The memory and his mood were getting to me. "But where did it go?" "I don't know. Berlin?" "No, that's just it," he said, his eyes bright, his voice now barely above a whisper. A huddle of sailors at the bar burst into raucous laughter, and the sudden sound actually made me jump, but Captain Jennings' eyes did not leave mine. There's no record of it going there, or being shot down. Allied air superiority was close to total by then. We know it was in the air over Germany. We spent the last months of the war in the waters of the Flensburg Firth, in the Schleswig-Holstein region of northwest Germany, where the last Nazi government holed up in the final weeks after Berlin fell and Hitler killed himself. The British have the airfield now, and I think your Messerschmitt Gigant may have gone there. I thought this through. If that was one of the last places to fall, that makes sense, I agreed. But why does it matter? Captain Jennings took a sip of his beer, glanced over his shoulder, and leaned forward. Because it wasn't the only cargo plane that went into Flensburg that remains accounted for, he said. So it was hidden away? He shook his head. You know what else Flensburg was famous for? He asked. Why we were in the area in the first place? I shook my head, my apprehension mounting. Submarine yards, he said. When the Germans surrendered, all U-boats that were at sea, according to the official story, were ordered to surrender. Many did not. Some were at large for months. Some remain unaccounted for. Some made for South America. No, I scoffed. It's too far. We would have been told. He smiled at that and shook his head slowly. When he spoke, it was in a measured tone, the information coming easily, as if he had spent a long time considering it. We have people in South America, he said. What do they say? They say the U-530, a Type 9C-40 submarine commanded by Otto Vermuth, reached Mar del Plata in Argentina on July 10th. U-977, a Type 7C, commanded by Heinz Schäfer, got there 2 weeks ago, having been off the radar for more than 2 months. No one knows exactly what route he took or where he went along the way. The last known base for the sub was Flensburg. He sat back. Why would the Nazis go to Argentina? I asked, intrigued in spite of myself. Jennings' face broke into a rueful smile. Because they can, he said. Perón is welcoming them with open arms, especially if they can pay, and a lot of them can. I stared at him, and he, knowing what I was thinking, nodded. The Nazi coffers were stuffed with all they had looted from Europe, particularly from its Jews. They go via Spain, because Franco lets them, said Jennings, or Genoa. There are Nazi sympathizers who cover for them, hide them, and there are others who just don't care who they are or what they have done, so long as they can pay. Either way, there are rat lines right to Buenos Aires and Rio, other places that we haven't found out about yet. Paraguay, maybe Chile, who knows where else. They go because they know what will happen if they stay. The war is over, I said. He seemed to consider that for a moment, then shrugged it off. The Allies have been saying for years that defeating the Nazis won't be the end for them, he said. There will be trials before the year's out. You know better than most what the Nazis did. There were crimes committed that go beyond simple war crimes. They know that, and they're bolting. Why are you telling me this? I asked. Because, he said, I think that some of what you saw in the Wenceslaus mine made it out of Germany. I have no idea if it made it onto one of those submarines, but I'd like to find out. And I'd like to be involved in making sure that the Nazis don't rise up, armed with whatever they were building in those underground factories, in South America. That still doesn't explain why you're telling me, I said, though I suspected the answer. Because it matters to you, he said. You pretend it doesn't, but it does. I shook my head, but I feared that if I tried to speak, my voice would break. We're going, he said. The crew of the Kitchener got our orders today. A long trip south to escort a pair of captured Nazi submarines back to New York. Come with us. I found my voice. What? I've been at sea for months. I finally get some solid ground under my feet, and you want me to go back on the water? Why do I have to keep telling people I'm not a sailor?
You could be, said Jennings. You've seen things, people, including some who are doing their damnedest to disappear. You're a witness, which could be useful in making sure that doesn't happen. You're also a citizen, or as near as makes no difference. Out of work, about to be dropped in a country you don't know, without friends or family to cushion the fall. And what better way to repay the government of the great nation that hauled your sorry Polish ass out of the water than to join up and serve on the very vessel that saved your hide? Sounds kind of poetic, don't you think?
He grinned then, and I found myself, ridiculously, impossibly, grinning back. It must have been the beer. 24. Allen, Dreamland, Nevada. Phase 2, as Marat called it, required another bus ride, and hours of sitting around waiting for clearance. By the time Allen, still annoyed by the implausibility of the flight simulator, went through his fourth security checkpoint, he decided that nothing could be worth the wait. He was wrong. Allen stood on an expansive runway as the moon rose over the dark Nevada cliffs, staring. He had known the Astra TR-3B Locust was supposed to be triangular, but seeing it still caught him off guard. Seen at from above, it would look like an equilateral triangle with a pair of vertical fins at the back. Standing on the airstrip and looking at it from the side, it was slim, with only a central bulge for the cockpit on the triangle's topside. Its lines smooth, even elegant, and its edge was blade-like. And it was black as the night itself. Indeed, the light from the floods above the hangar seemed to fall into it. With a low hiss of air, a panel near the center of the ship folded down, revealing three steps into the body of the craft. Marat pulled his helmet on and checked his comms as he led the way, stooping beneath what Allen still wanted to call the wing, though the whole ship was a kind of wing. The struts of the landing gear were tall and slender, not designed for conventional takeoff or landing, but sturdy enough to roll the ship out into the open. Allen tried not to stare, to give away his fascination with each new aspect of the craft that he discovered, and took refuge in pulling his helmet over his head as he climbed the stairs into the belly of the Locust. There were two seats, side by side. The inside of the cockpit was exactly as the simulator had promised, which came as something of a surprise, given how skeptical he had been of the machine he had just left. Allen wore a flight helmet, unlike any he'd ever worn before, though he'd heard similar devices had been developed for the F-35. It was snug and new-smelling, and it gave him the option of seeing beyond the aircraft itself, via a complex set of digital projections, effectively making the ship around him transparent. In any other circumstances, he would have found the possibilities thrilling. But tonight, he wanted to stay focused on the Locust itself. Absurd though the simulator had been, he was sure the Locust was capable of maneuvers his Harrier was not. He took his seat, buckled himself in with a 5-point harness, then tapped the silvery rectangle. Once buckled in, Marat turned his seat to face Allen and began touching control buttons, talking as he did so. "This is the standby mode, which brings online your communication and navigation systems. See this here? This is the home preset. If you get into difficulties, hit this button here. Wherever you are in the world, at whatever altitude, the craft will return to this point by the fastest, safest available route. It's designed to tap into any available satellite system to track air traffic and adjust its flight path accordingly. Best autopilot function ever devised. And if the system is compromised? You'd be amazed how much it takes to stop that function from working. Multiple built-in redundancies. But if it really can't get you home, it will let you know. If that happens, and I've never known it to, you'll have other things to worry about." He paused, then spoke. "Pre-flights check out? Murat asked into his headset. You're green, Flight Control responded. Nightbird 1 primed for departure. Roger that, Nightbird 1, said the flight controller. When you're ready. Much appreciated, said Murat. Kick the tires and light the fires, Alan said. Old pilot saying. After all, for all its mystery, the Locust was still just a plane. Murat was talking again. This light indicates when you're in free space, where there's room to lift off. You have proximity detectors here, which will alert you to any interference. Birds, power lines, you name it. Though bird strikes aren't usually an issue. There's no air intake, like on a conventional jet, so you don't suck geese through your fans. Not that they come near, anyway. Why not? They just sense us. Not sure why. Of course, if you're moving very fast, bird strikes are still possible, but they don't endanger the ship's performance. He reached for one of the wall consoles and popped it out of its housing like a tablet computer. This is your main power readout, he said. It won't activate if surrounding conditions are unfavorable. But we're clear of the hangar now, so... Watch this sequence. He tapped a series of buttons, replaced the tablet in the console, and reached for a silvery rectangle glowing beside it. Nightbird 1 to flight control, he said into his headset mic. Permission to activate flight systems. Granted, Nightbird 1, said the voice in Alan's earphones. Happy flying. Murat gave Alan a nod and, with the thrill of understanding, Alan reached for the console and touched the blinking amber square of light till it turned green. With a faint hum that resonated through his body, the ship became something subtly different from what it had been. That made no sense, he knew, but that was how it felt. The Locust was still sitting on its spindly landing gear, but, Alan thought, not really. They were touching the ground, but that, it seemed, was a choice, and not the result of basic gravitational physics. For all intents and purposes, Alan thought, they were already flying. Retract the gear, and the ship would just hang there, he was sure of it, dangling in empty space. Not so much hovering, since that took thrust, as floating. He could feel it, a curious and inexplicable weightlessness about the ship, unlike anything he had ever felt in a plane before. Let's give her a little altitude, shall we? Said Murat. Alan swallowed, then did what Beaker had told him, pushing slightly on the vertical thrust lever. He watched all around, instruments, scanners, windows, as he set the craft into its vertical ascent. But still, he couldn't believe his eyes. The Locust rose steadily into the desert sky. But there was no sense of the force doing the lifting, no pressure, no registering in his body that they were moving at all, beyond a slight oscillation of the craft as it climbed, as if it were floating on a rippling cushion of air. Strangest of all, for a pilot used to the bellow and shriek of jet engines, there was no sound, other than a low cycling hum that was less a noise than a vague awareness. Something felt in the pit of the stomach and the bones of the skull. This can't be. It had to be an illusion, another bad simulation. The Locust continued to rise, but Alan's body felt nothing. The ship just drifted up to, according to the readout, 56 meters, then stopped. There had been a fractional shudder as they left the ground, and then only that minute undulation, like they were a cork on a still sea, rising and falling so slightly that you could barely sense it at all. Landing gear away, said Murat, pulling a little lever. The dull whir and snuck of the wheels being stowed sounded loud in the stillness. He paused and looked at Alan. The visors on their helmets were still up, and Murat met his eyes. You okay? Sure, said Alan. More fake casualness. No sweat. Don't want to know what's holding us up? Alan's hesitation was so small he doubted Murat saw it. Will we crash if I don't know? He asked. No.
Then let's go. I want to see what this thing can do.
If it had been a test, Marat's grin said he had passed.
We'll stay over the base tonight, said Marat, all business again. But you can practice some maneuvering.
How long can we stay airborne like this?
Without moving?
Indefinitely. Turn off the directional acceleration systems, and we go dark. No external lights would be visible from the ground. We're just here. Going dark also turns off detection countermeasures, however. So, though we're invisible to the naked eye, we'll show up on radar. But yeah, power everything down, and we can hang here in the air forever.
Alan wanted to ask how that was possible, but buried the thought. Take her up to 2,000 feet, said Marat, and you can see how she handles.
They did, and Alan moved the craft out around Papoose Mountain, first manually, then using preset coordinates entered automatically as the ship moved. They moved at a steady 300 knots, but there was, as before, no sense of drag, thrust, or turbulence as they moved. Alan was reminded of a hot air balloon, drifting. Its weight somehow canceled out, so they moved like dandelion seeds. Alan realized he was holding his breath, and deliberately let it out again.
Hold it here, said Marat.
Alan cut the thrust, mouth dry, speechless. The craft hung in the sky in a controlled drift, level, but rippling fractionally. Years ago, when Alan had still been with Lacey, he had taken her up in a hot air balloon in the foothills of the Blue Ridge Mountains, his last great romantic gesture, complete with champagne and strawberries. It hadn't worked, and a month later, she was gone for good. But he remembered what it had been like in the balloon, moving soundlessly, when the burner wasn't roaring, through the sky, unobserved by the deer and rabbits who went about their business below, oblivious. That's what this felt like, an entirely different experience from being in any kind of plane.
Looking good from here, Nightbird One, said the voice of flight control. Sending coordinates to your nav system now.
Roger that, flight control, said Marat. Coordinates received. Engaging directional control and locking on.
Alan watched the console as the navigational computer processed the input.
Take her over there on your mark, Phoenix, said Marat. Nice and easy.
Alan adjusted the controls, and the Locust suddenly slipped sideways, speeding east at something close to 500 knots, so that the world below was a nauseating blur. Or should have been. In fact, there was no nausea at all, and though he was moving too fast for his eyes to make sense of anything, Alan's body remained cool, unfazed, as if he was sitting in a bar, watching the world go by, but at supersonic speeds.
There now, Phoenix, said Marat. That wasn't so bad, was it? You're in safe mode now and practically invisible to any technology we know of. Try moving the ship around to get the feel of the controls. Your nav screen will show you the safe zone. Your operational shelf tonight is between 5,000 and 25,000 feet. Let's try some manual control.
Roger that, said Alan,
still trying to wrap his mind around the way the Locust had moved. He engaged the manual system and cupped his hand over the red trackball on his armrest. He rolled it gently, and the Locust pivoted in place. He did it again, this time applying a little thrust with the other hand, and the ship changed direction again, leaping hard to the west, and then climbing in a dizzying spiral before screaming back to the southeast. Of course, there was no screaming, except perhaps inside Alan's head, as the laws of physics seemed to implode with each movement the craft made. No sound, no torque, no G-force, no inertia. It was, if anything, smoother than the simulator had been, which was impossible. As the ship moved at Alan's bidding, he gaped and stared, mouth parched, eyes dry, because he didn't blink for fear of missing something. And even though he was the one piloting the craft, he felt strangely irrelevant, all his knowledge and experience of flying rendered null and void by the way the locust handled. The word that had slid unsummoned into his head already ricocheted around like cannon fire. Impossible. All of it. It couldn't be true. But it was, and it changed everything. Alan gazed at the land beneath him and the sky above, his mind chasing the vectors, acceleration and related calculations the ship seemed to make with an ease so complete that it did not even register on the inside. It was, in every possible sense of the word, awesome. When Morant's voice came in over the headset, Alan realized that he had almost forgotten the other man sitting beside him entirely.
"You okay, Major?"
"Yeah," said Alan. "Or at least, I will be."
"Understood," said Morant. "I think that's enough for your first night. I think you get the idea."
Except, of course, that Alan didn't. Not really. Back on the ground, Alan was silent as they left in the blacked-out bus. There was something about the way Hatcher patted him understandingly on the shoulder, which said that his mood was not unexpected. They were used to it, this stunned sense that reality was not what it seemed.
"Let's take the rest of the night off," said Hatcher. "Mr. Morant, take the Major for a beer."
Alan was relieved that the planned beer would not be on the base. But there were things to say first, things that could not be said anywhere but Dreamland. He requested a debriefing room, a place, he said, where they could talk openly and without fear of being overheard. Hatcher did not hesitate, but neither did he ask what was on Alan's mind, or if he could sit in. This was pilot talk. He led them down a series of hallways, swiped his badge through three separate doors, and showed their clearance IDs to the guard with the submachine gun on duty outside the designated meeting room. "And remember, gentlemen," he said, showing them into the comfortably appointed but predictably deserted lounge. "Careless talk." Costs lives, Alan thought, recalling the old wartime motto. "Say what you like in here," Hatcher concluded, "but only here. Then get your beer, like a regular person. Just remember that you aren't one. Not anymore." And with that, he left them. Morant took bottled water from a fridge, tossed one to Alan, and waited. The room hummed with the textured hiss of the white noise speakers on the walls.
"How can you live with it?" Alan asked.
Morant gave him a level stare.
"With what?"
"The—" Alan fought for the word.
"The sheer physics of it."
Morant glanced fractionally around before answering, making sure no one had come in.
"I don't need to understand digital recording or sound compression and reproduction to enjoy a bit of Taylor Swift on my iPod," he said with a shrug. "I'm a pilot, not an engineer."
Alan scowled.
"You listen to Taylor Swift?"
Morant shrugged and grinned, but Alan didn't let him derail his train of thought.
"No one ever told you Taylor Swift on an iPod was a theoretical impossibility," he said. "You haven't lived your life according to, premised on, that assumption."
"True," said Morant, taking a sip of his water.
"You lived your life on the premise that there could be no more advanced form of flight than what you've been trained to do in a Harrier. What if you grew up flying a Spitfire or a Sopwith Camel, and then someone showed you the Harrier? Would that change your view of the world?"
"No," said Alan.
"Yes, kind of. But this is a different order of magnitude."
He leaned in, lowering his voice.
"This isn't just going faster or higher than we thought we could. This is a fundamentally different notion of travel. According to everything I've ever heard, it's not possible. Those aerial maneuvers I just did, the changes of direction, the acceleration, that's..."
"What?"
"That's not flying. It's just a different kind of flying."
Alan shook his head.
"I don't know what that means," he said.
"No, and if I'm really honest," said Morant, "neither do I. But you know what? It works. You've seen it.
I just don't understand how it's possible that..."
Yeah, yeah, said Marat, and his smile was brittle now. So you keep saying. Let me see your phone.
What?
Your phone, let me see it.
Alan fished in his pocket and pushed the iPhone across the table.
State of the art, said Marat, impressed.
For now, Alan replied.
Right, said the other man with a meaningful stare. But even if it wasn't, what do you have here?
A communication device that allows you to talk to people all over the world.
This phone is a computer that can process more data in less time than anything involved in the Apollo space program that put men on the moon. You've got digital pictures and video, music.
I know.
So?
So imagine taking this back in time 1,000 years or less. Say a couple of hundred. Imagine you could walk into the house of George Washington with all your networks and servers functioning, and show him what that little device could do. What do you think the people of the time would say?
Alan frowned.
I guess they'd be pretty impressed, he said, grudgingly, guessing where Marat was going.
No, Marat replied. Not impressed. They'd freak the fuck out. They'd be terrified. They'd say it was witchcraft. They'd say it wasn't possible, that such a thing could not exist in the world as they knew it.
Alan said nothing. What you saw today is a leap forward, a quantum leap, if you like, but a leap forward in technology and theoretical understanding way beyond our pay grade. But it ain't witchcraft.
I get that, said Alan, but I'm a pilot. I know about flying.
Sure you do, said Marat. Thrust against drag. Lift and angle of attack to generate turn cheese, right?
You were dead on.
A Sopwith Camel pilot could get his head around a Harrier.
Action and reaction. Objects in motion stay in motion, unless acted on by a force. That's what Newton figured out, right?
And invented calculus to analyze.
A fighter pilot has Newtonian physics baked into our muscle memory.
But think on this. Didn't Einstein already grasp that Newtonian physics are just a useful approximation for the world and speeds we live in? Or that space and time are a continuum, and both bend and curve?
Astrophysicists can see the evidence around neutron stars and black holes.
Einstein lenses bending space.
But the useful engineering of non-Newtonian physics into applied technology, why, that's as far out as telling old Ben Franklin that your iPhone is just the engineering of the electricity he is experimenting with in his kites and Leyden jars. Bend space and time under commanded control, non-Newtonian, and there's no action-reaction, no force needed to equal acceleration you'd feel in the cockpit. The engineering of such technology? Well, that's more than you need to know. But it ain't magic. And the sooner you get used to the idea that it's real, the longer you'll last up there. Capiche?
Alan blinked, looked at him, and nodded.
It hadn't been a threat. Not really. A caution, perhaps. And a useful one.
After the bus ride back to Groom Lake, the two of them sitting silently in the cool interior, looking at nothing, the driver took them to their respective quarters to change out of their flight gear, asking them politely to return in civilian attire. For Marat, this meant jeans and a worn open-necked shirt that made him look like someone Alan had never seen before. Alan ruffled his hair a bit and pushed the sleeves up on his wrinkle-free, no-iron Oxford shirt, but he knew that anyone with half a brain would spot him for military. The bus driver looked them over as if inspecting them, then drove them to a carpool near the main gate, where Marat signed for the keys to a tan Lincoln Town Car. The driver started to offer directions, but Marat cut him off.
I know the way.
They could hardly get lost. Once through a series of security checkpoints, they drove northwest on Highway 375 for a couple of miles, twice navigating around black steers that watched them curiously, until they came to what had to be the smallest town Alan had ever seen.
Say hello to Rachel, said Marat. Population 50, give or take. There's no point trying not to stand out, because you're gonna, whatever you do. But let's not advertise what we do, okay?
Alan nodded. As to where they would get the promised beer, their choice was not so much limited as non-existent. There was a single-story white building, surrounded by mobile homes, which Alan took to be guest rooms, set on a piece of barren land by the service road, the main building flying a U.S. flag. It proclaimed itself the Little A. Lee Inn, restaurant, bar, motel. A classic big-eyed alien head logo, painted roughly beneath, said, "Earthlings, welcome." A couple of big-rig tractor trailers were parked out front, and across the road there was a pickup truck with a small crane in the bed, from which a model flying saucer was suspended. "Seriously?" said Alan. "Welcome to the extraterrestrial highway," said Marat, with a sideways grin and an eye roll. "Don't tell anyone what you were doing this morning, or the entire place will have a heart attack." Alan would have preferred something big and loud, where he could hole up in a corner with a frosty mug, regularly refilled, and not think about what he'd seen today. But the inn looked homey and welcoming enough. The place was a theme park of alien paraphernalia and kitsch, and its menu matched. The kitchens were about to close for the night, so Alan ordered an alien burger with macaroni salad, which was good, but not as good as the fries Marat got. The beer was standard domestic, which was fine by Alan, though Marat sneered. But it was ice cold. Alan ordered two more, as soon as the first ones arrived. They talked about nothing. Baseball and Bruce Springsteen, cars, and whether the first alien film was better than the second. Conversation was pleasant enough, even if Marat knew surprisingly little about what Alan thought was common knowledge. How did anyone not know that the Jets were football and the Rangers were hockey? But it was also intentionally empty and guarded. They were careful to say nothing about where they worked or what they did, which meant that, at least from Alan's perspective, the conversation had no weight, no substance. His gaze flicked away and landed on the window pane, where a pale banded gecko clung to the glass with the ridges of its padded toes. "How those burgers working out for you, hon?" the waitress chirped. "Great," said Marat. "Perfect." Alan managed the nod and a smile, but as soon as she sauntered away, he went back to watching the gecko. What had Hatcher said? "Get your beer like a regular person. Just remember that you aren't one. Not anymore." That was about the size of it. They finished their beers in silence, and, though Alan ordered another, the two men did not speak again until they were ready to drive back to the base, nicknamed, Alan recalled, both ironically and aptly, Dreamland. 25. Jennifer, Hampshire, England. Back in her room, Jennifer inserted the flash drive she'd found concealed in her father's model railway landscape into her laptop and tried to make sense of what she saw. There were no letters to her, no narratives of any kind, just spreadsheets of names and dates and account numbers, none of it familiar to her, according to what she had seen on her father's laptop. She knew the numbers represented money. Lots of it. Billions of pounds moved around by the Maynard Consortium across nation-states and through corporations whose names she did not know. Most of it seemed to funnel eventually into an entity called, simply, Sweep. Nothing in the documents gave any sign as to what Sweep was, what it made or sold, where it was, or who ran it. It was just a name, possibly an acronym. She looked the company up, but there was nothing online, no trace of it at all. She had assumed the flash drive would answer all her questions, but it had only raised others and given her larger mysteries to work with. Some of the names in the files were not companies. They were people, individuals in a variety of professions and places, which simple online searches quickly reveal. English lawyers, German financiers, Russian industrialists, even one U.S. senator who she remembered visiting Steddings when she was an adolescent, a friend of her father's. They probably all had ties, of some sort, to Sweep, whatever that was, and none of it had shown up in any of the Maynard Group's records or files or, for that matter, their boardroom discussions. It smelled wrong. But smell, she thought, as she sipped the last of her father's Lagavulin, wasn't nearly enough to go on. She was going to have to do some exploring. But where to start? In this utterly unfamiliar world, she couldn't imagine. She doubted Deacon would have any more insights than she had, unless he knew more about her father's dealings than he'd let on. She was about to close the drive when she saw a notepad app. She clicked on it, and it opened, revealing a single three-word message. Talk to Latrange. The handsome face of the young man at the Maynard Group came to mind. Latrange. He'd asked her to call him Dan. She reread those three loaded words. Was it her father making a note to himself? A plan? A decision? Was it a message to her from beyond the grave? A place to start getting answers? Or was it none of these? A fraction of a memo that had accidentally been included among all this secret data? No, she thought. The flash drive had been stowed in a hurry, a desperate act, designed for no one but her. And her father was a careful man. The message was intended for her. It had to be. Did that make the dark-eyed man merely a source of information? Or was he someone her father had trusted? Someone she should trust? No, she thought again. He had been nicer to her than the other board members, felt different from them. But that was just his relative youth and manner. It was no reason to take him into her confidence. But someone in that room had wanted her to poke around. She felt sure of it. And with the half-message from her father still glowing on the screen in front of her, it seemed more likely Latrange than any of the other 10. What had Deacon said about making leaps of faith as the beginning of trust? She reached for the suit jacket she'd thrown over the back of a chair, fished in the pocket for Latrange's business card, picked up her mobile, and dialed the number before she could change her mind. He answered immediately, but there was wariness in his voice as he gave his name. "This is Jennifer Quinn," she said. "I was wondering if we might meet." She didn't tell Deacon, not because she didn't trust him, but because she knew he would caution her against doing anything rash. She felt like being rash, needed it. She had spent the last few days in what felt like a fog, feeling her way cautiously, led by other people who assumed she had no place even being there. She had to take decisive action. But she was not an idiot. The meeting was to test the waters, nothing more. She would not tell Latrange, Dan, about the data her father had squirreled away from her, and her alone, no matter how charming he was. She spent the morning poring over the files on the flash drive, tracking Maynard's investments, going all the way back to the year it was founded in the late 40s, a quarter of a century before her father got involved, its finance emerging from Swiss accounts. Records from those days were only partial, but even then, the primary recipients of the consortium's funding seemed to have been shadow corporations that had left no trace on the Internet. The companies and their assets were always global, scattered across the world, but seemingly unconnected, and they tended to melt away after a few years, until Sweep appeared in 1964. It looked like it grew out of a conglomeration of previous corporations, though the historical record was so tangled at this point that she couldn't be sure. It seemed to quietly swallow up the other companies, until it was moving hundreds of billions of dollars, pounds, euros, and other currencies through the Caymans and Seychelles, through Liechtenstein, Vanuatu, Belize, and Singapore. There was no record of it in any public documentation, though its various activities must clearly have put an invisible hand on various world markets and stock exchanges. That was more than strange. It was either all nonsense, or it was criminal. "Dad," she thought, the fact of it settling in her gut like a stone. "What did you do?" She let Latrange choose the place, a pub close to the Earl's Court tube station called, bafflingly, the Prince of Tech. He offered no explanation for his choice, except to say that he would be in the area, and though its ordinariness surprised her, she was glad she was meeting him in a place where she didn't feel like she had to behave like some under-accessorized Sloan Ranger. She ordered a glass of Glenmorangie Signy at the bar, took a stool at a plain wooden table by the window, and watched the traffic on Earl's Court Road. Latrange, when he arrived, was casual chic in a close-fitting dark suit without a tie. But if he was a regular in the pub, no one greeted him as such. He carried an attaché case, which he slid under the table. "You came," he said. "We made the plan only a few hours ago," Jennifer answered, slightly defensive. "Of course I came." He smiled at that, then took a step closer to the bar and, with a single word, "pint," and a nod at one of the pumps, ordered. It was an easy, confident gesture, the action of a man accustomed to being in charge. Jennifer decided to be unimpressed. "I hadn't expected your call," he said, sipping his beer. "To be honest, I thought I'd pissed you off." Jennifer shrugged. "Partly. I was just in a bad mood," she conceded. "Understandable," he answered. "But also," she said, recovering her steel, "well, you know, the company you keep." He smiled. "It's not a crime to be rich, Miss Quinn. I thought you would understand that."
"Because I am, you mean?"
"I don't think that follows. Inheriting my father's money just means I know more than most people do about how it was acquired, what it does and doesn't do, and who it supports, and who it keeps in their place. It's not a pretty picture."
"I think you're the richest socialist I know," he answered.
"Because I have a conscience and resources. That's supposed to be a contradiction?" Her words were clipped, but you could feel the heat in her face. This wasn't the way she'd intended the meeting to go.
"I just think," he said, "that when you champion the underclasses from a position of privilege, you wind up pleasing neither those you are trying to help, who resent you as a noblesse oblige do-gooder who goes home to a palace at the end of the day, nor your own people, who think you're a class traitor. Must make for a pretty miserable and lonely existence."
"If by my own people, you mean the kinds I went to school with, the ones who spend their time shopping or watching horse shows. I was never one of them. And for all of his other faults, my father knew it."
"And accepted it?"
"Eventually."
"And yet here you are," he said.
He wasn't smiling now, and the air was sharp with tension.
"Here I am," she said. "Because he's dead, and he wanted me to take over for him, and maybe bring my socialist sensibility to his work, and undo some of the things he'd been complicit in."
"You can't know that," said Latrange. "You just don't want to think he had second thoughts about the kinds of business you did with him."
"Oh, please," snapped Latrange. "Don't canonize him, now that he's not around to disappoint you."
If she had been holding her glass as he said it, she would have thrown it in his face. As it was, she had to reach for it, and that split second gave her the moment she needed to restrain herself. She gripped the glass and held it deliberately in place. But the speed of her action had already spoken volumes.
"I'm sorry," said Latrange. "That was out of line. Perhaps I should leave you to finish your drink in peace."
She considered the offer seriously, but the heat was already draining, as if his apology had released the pressure, and she was suddenly herself again. She shook her head wearily.
"I'm sorry, too," she said. "I have not been myself lately, and this is all very stressful. I hope I haven't disrupted your day too much. This was clearly a mistake."
She rose to leave, but his hand was suddenly on hers, gentle, tentative.
"Don't go," he said. "This was entirely my fault. I'm afraid I'm not used to having the ethics of my profession called into question.
You touched the nerve, but that's my problem, not yours. And since you obviously didn't call me so that you could bask in my charming personality, why did you tell me why you wanted to see me?" For a moment, she hesitated, feeling the creeping exhaustion of the last few days. And then she sat, staring at her half-empty glass to avoid his eyes. He sat, too, giving her a moment to collect herself. "What do you know about sweep?" she asked, only looking at him as she uttered the final word. She hadn't intended to mention the name. She knew it would reveal that she had access to information someone had tried to keep from her, but she didn't know how else to proceed. And she was curious. She wanted to see how he reacted. Sweep. Possibly an acronym. Possibly a front. But certainly the recipient of a lot of Maynard Corporation money. She watched his face. For a moment, he did not react at all, as if he were waiting for more information. Then he frowned and shook his head. Sweep? He repeated. I don't understand. Is that a thing or some kind of practice? A thing, she answered. If he was lying, he was good at it. A company. It's where a lot of Maynard's money has been going. His frown deepened, and there was something else in his eyes now. Doubt. Incredulity. Since when? He said. The name first appears in the mid-60s, but I think it existed before then, under other names. I've never heard of it, he said. You must have something wrong. If Maynard had serious investments in this sweep, whatever it is. Not just serious investments, she cut in. Massive. If that were the case, I'd know. You're what, 35, 38? A good 15 years younger than anyone else on the board. Until you showed up. So? And you've been a member for 2 years. You're saying that I'm not senior enough to know what's going on? He sounded stung. Sometimes there are inner circles within organizations, said Jennifer. They don't always share the most important material with the more junior. Thanks, he glared at her. You know, a better solution to all this, frankly, rather rude skepticism about my position on the board, and your implication of cloak and dagger funding, which would almost certainly be in violation of all manner of international laws, is that you have bad data. Where did you get this sweep nonsense?
I found it among my father's things.
In what form? A note? A letter? Maybe you misinterpreted. Files detailing thousands of money transfers, she said. Names, places, account details. The lot. Hidden away, where he knew only I would find it. Why would he do that? Because he knew he was in danger and didn't trust anyone else, she said. The idea hadn't registered with quite that much hard-edged clarity before. But she saw it now, and it touched something in her heart, so that her voice quavered on the last word. Whatever this sweep is, Dad was murdered for it. Latrange stared at her. But when he spoke, it was with a kind of resignation. His suicide was unexpected, he said. I don't think I really believed it. You're sure?
Pretty sure, she said.
I wasn't before, because I didn't know why someone might want him dead. But now. And he said I should talk to you. This time, the surprise really did register on Latrange's face, though it was quickly doused, such that she couldn't tell how he felt about the revelation. At last he smiled mirthlessly, acknowledging that she had indeed thrown him a bone.
Which is why you're here, he said.
Yes, she answered. My father thought you knew something that would help, and perhaps he thought you were not in as deep as the others. He thought I could trust you. She said it stiffly, conceding nothing, and at last he nodded. Sweep, he said. His voice was still musing, baffled, but he took a swallow of his beer and came up with something like resolution in his eyes. What do you want me to do? I could speak to the board.
No, she said. That wouldn't achieve anything. It might even be dangerous.
Dangerous? He echoed, his black eyes wide and alarmed. You don't really think.
The first thing to do, she said, ignoring the question, is make sure we know what we're dealing with. I can't make sense out of all the data. But maybe if you took a look at the files.
Certainly, he said. Who else have you told?
Jennifer hesitated for only a second.
No one, she said. Not even Deacon?
She shook her head,
but the question tripped some vague alarm. Was it obvious that she might confide in her dead father's manservant? Would anyone make that guess? Or did it suggest Latrange knew more than he'd let on?
I need to make a phone call, he said.
Who to?
She was wary now, suddenly and inexplicably doubtful that she had done the right thing. She hadn't meant to confide this much, and some part of her worried that it had been a mistake to do so. He seemed to see something in her face, and, as if in response, squeezed his eyes shut in furious thought for a moment.
My name is not Latrange, he said.
Of all the things he might have said, this was something she'd been unprepared for. She blinked, but said nothing. He reached under the table to his attaché case, opened it, and drew out a wallet, which he flipped open. The blue card inside showed his picture, but the name below it read Robert Chevalier. It was followed by an agent number. The card bore a crest featuring a globe with a sword behind it. The white capital letters across the top read, Interpol.
26. Tamika, Pottsville, Pennsylvania. The motel offered no complimentary breakfast, so Tamika loaded up the car and stopped off at a Dunkin' Donuts, 3 blocks from the Yuengling Brewery in downtown Pottsville, before heading north on Route 61 towards the wooded hills of Locust Lake State Park. She found the little Presbyterian church, set back from the road, surrounded by pine trees. It was white clapboard, with a tower for a single bell, and the sign out front advertised a bake sale and a children's Sunday service. It looked like the kind of rural church that would be featured on Hallmark Christmas cards, surrounded by snow and an artfully positioned minister. A white church, Tamika thought, in both senses of the word. She felt conspicuous, trying the door and pushing her way inside. It was dimly lit, bathed in the glow from tall, narrow-stained glass windows. It smelled of furniture oils and brass polish, and its pews were straight and regular, equipped with ancient hymnals, all exactly as the exterior promised. Simple and plain. There was no one there. The silence felt heavy, like accumulated dust, or the memory of something long finished. The only sign that this was still an active house of worship, and not some recreated living museum like old Sturbridge, was the string of paper dolls looped between the half columns molded into the walls and trailing along the benches. They'd been cut out of white cardstock, the way people used to make holiday trimmings. The paper folded many times so that each scissor snip made cuts that echoed through the stack. As a kid, she'd always been delighted and amazed when she did it right and opened up the folded mass to reveal the streamer of repeated shapes. She assumed they had been made for the children's service advertised outside, strings of paper children holding hands. It was a cheap, old-fashioned display, in keeping with the rest of the chapel, but it touched something in her and made her thoughtful. She sat at the back in a corner pew and waited, but the hour came and went without any sign of Katerina or anyone else from the Hollows. She waited 50 minutes before deciding the old woman wasn't coming. As she waited, the paper dolls acquired an altogether different aspect. Their skeletal whiteness in the empty church, standing in for all the people who weren't there, a ghostly echo chilling by virtue of its childishness. Tamika closed the church door behind her and stepped out into the cool air with something like relief. She considered driving out to the lake, but there was no reason to believe Katerina had been telling the truth about the outing. The appointment at the church had probably been a ruse to get rid of her. Whatever kind of strange, luxurious prison the Hollows was, the old woman wanted no help from Tamika in escaping it. For a moment, she considered driving back there, but the guards would surely be watching for her, and she wouldn't be as lucky today as she'd been yesterday. She got into her car and called Marvin, but he didn't pick up. and she could think of nothing to say in a message. Having no idea of where to go, she read from Jersey's journal for a half hour. She kept one eye open for the van that might still bring Katerina Lundegrass to her meeting. But the two or three cars she saw in the next 10 minutes did not slow. The phone rang. Marvin.
"Hey," she said. "Nothing much to report," he said. "But I have the address of that other old folks' home for you, the Silver Birches. Want it?"
She had forgotten that the caterer had revealed one of the other locations he delivered to. It might be nothing, but since she had no other leads, it was worth a look. She drove back towards Pottsville, following Marvin's directions. She missed one turn as she swung into the west side of town, but doubled back easily and found herself face to face with the Silver Birches. It was a more modern building, in the Swiss chalet style, and the gardens looked younger, the trees showing something of the nursery's evenness, arranged with military regularity, like little green nutcrackers. A sign by the drive advertised the assisted living facility's pool, and another said that there was now a vacancy, which suggested, to make a thought bleakly, that someone had recently died. It felt quite different from the Hollows, but there was another of those Checkpoint Charlie-style gates, with a friendly-looking uniformed officer, complete with radio and sidearm. Tamika drove past without making eye contact. At the Hollows, she talked her way in and improvised her way out over the wall. But that wouldn't work this time. If there was a connection between the two residencies, they would be watching for her. In the absence of any better ideas, she opted to simply reverse the process. Over the wall in, talk your way out. So she drove, keeping the brick perimeter on her right and her peripheral vision, slowing when the brick wall became the stone blocks of a different neighboring facility. 100 yards further down was another gate, broad and unguarded, its driveway leading to what was advertised as a private tennis club and spa. Good enough. She drove in, parked in the lot, then walked not towards the glass and chrome gym, where she would probably need a pass, but into the trees that lined the wall separating the spa from the Silver Birches. This is becoming a habit, she thought, as she checked over her shoulder. Then shinnied up a tree, breathing heavily, and hopped the wall. Still better to do it when you're not being chased by armed guards. As soon as she dropped into the grounds of the Silver Birches, she could smell the tang of charcoal smoke and something sweet that made her mouth water. Grilling meat. In spite of the chill, someone was determined to treat spring as spring. There were no wooded landscapes, as there had been at the Hollows. Just the trimly regimented trees mulched and spaced to give them room to grow. The garden would look its best for another 5 years. It meant she had no cover. She made for the house, taking in the numerous cars and vans parked outside. Perhaps the barbecue, informal, outdoors, mingly, would be the perfect way to slip in. She followed her nose down the side of the house, past the obligatory conservatory, and round to an extensive rear patio with potted plants and a fire pit. And people. 7 of them. 6 men and 1... Katerina Lundegrass. Tamika turned on her heel before she was observed, and tried the closest door into the house, thinking furiously. She was in the conservatory, and she was not alone. It looked a lot like a common room at the Hollows, lots of indoor greenery, and old people chatting, drinking coffee, and playing cards. She moved with her back to the windows, slipping around a healthy ficus, and sat down next to an old white man. They were all old and white. She could forget about being inconspicuous. "Hello," she said. To her surprise, the man beamed at her, his smile peeling off a good 15 years. "Hello, my dear," he said. "And what's your name?"
"I'm Ashley," said Tamika reflexively. "I'm from Social Services, routine inspection."
"Social Services? Here?" he said. Well, I suppose you have to make sure they aren't poisoning us for our estates. Not that there's much left to inherit, once all this has been paid for.
D'Amica nodded and smiled.
So you're happy with your care, Mr. Sanderson, he answered. Call me Chuck.
He took her hand and, to her amazement, raised it quickly to his lips.
Enchanté, he said. What lovely skin you have.
If that was his way of signaling that he wasn't a racist, D'Amica thought, it was clumsy, but nicer than most. She found herself smiling. Not joining the barbecue, Chuck? She asked, turning so that she could shoot a furtive look at Katerina through the window.
Private party, said Chuck with a shrug. Not invited. Never.
Never? Said D'Amica with mock amazement.
Fred's buddies, said Chuck.
D'Amica thought.
Frederick Kaas? She asked. That's the fella. Traveling salesman, or so he says.
You don't believe him?
Once told me he sold vacuum cleaners door to door, he said. Now, my old man worked for Sears. As a kid, I knew more about vacuum cleaners than was good for a boy. So I started firing model names and numbers at old Fred there. And I'd swear on my old man's grave, he never heard of any of them.
So what do you think he did? Chuck Sanderson shrugged expansively.
He used to have a pal who visited him every few days. Funny fella by the name of Siegfried something. Meyer, something like that. Engineer.